You're listening to 830 AM KSDP in Sandpoint, Alaska, K201DA in King Cove, Alaska.
Circle Advocates John Schroff and Diane DeSanto for their commitment to and financial investment in high-value public news and programming in Alaska.
Alaska Public Media presents this special broadcast of Paleo Nerds. Outdoor Explorer will return later this summer.
Ray.
Hello, David. How you doing, man?
I'm doing good. It's so great to talk to you. I really love our Paleo Nerds. I love our intros. I love, it's just so much fun to dive in. Every time you find a guest, I'm spending a week watching them on YouTube and listening to their podcasts and learning so much more about
the various topics.
Another topic.
Yeah.
Yeah, like turtles.
Turtles. Yeah, we're going to talk turtles and dinosaurs. I really want to talk dinosaurs first, and then we'll dive into the turtles, okay? Deal?
I'm all for that. Okay. So, Ray, our guest today, Tyler Leeson, you met when he was a kid, right?
Yeah, Tyler, when he was a kid up in Marmarth, North Dakota.
Wait, you and Kirk were doing a Cruise on the Fossil Freeway road trip, right?
Yeah.
And he was on one of your stops.
Kirk was taking me, the artist guy, his sidekick around. We left from the Denver Museum of Nature and Science, where... coincidentally, Tyler now works.
That's right. So, Tyler now is the associate curator of vertebrate paleontology at the Denver Museum of Science and Nature. Did I get it right?
More or less.
Nature and Science.
I will introduce him when we get him on the phone properly.
No worries.
Okay, so why don't we call him up, man?
Yeah, and we'll find out all about the story you're about to tell. So let me go into Mountain Time. I'm dialing from Pacific Time, and it's pretty much instant. So here we go.
Hey, Dave, meet Tyler Leeson, vertebrate paleontologist and associate curator of vertebrate paleontology at the Denver Museum of Nature and Science. And hey, Tyler, so good to see you, man.
Oh, man. Thanks for having me. This is awesome. It's great seeing you guys.
Yeah.
I love your
nice
podcast.
To meet you. Well, thank you. Oh, you actually listen.
I have. Yep.
Well, as you know, one of the first questions I ask, and I'm just kind of getting old, Ray. I don't have to really ask this anymore because they're all paleo nerds. So
well, I like how they answer. Come on, ask him.
So, hey, are you a paleo nerd?
Oh, I'm a paleo nerd. Everyone's deep.
I want to say you are one of the few paleo nerds that has grown up in the middle of like one of the richest fossil areas on the planet. And right?
Yeah, I mean, I hit the jackpot for being a paleo nerd and where I grew up, right in the middle of the North Dakota Badlands, Hell Creek Formation.
Right there.
I feel like everybody that grows up there should be a paleo nerd.
Yeah,
right?
There's
fossils
everywhere.
So you're in a tiny town?
Marmarth.
Yeah, Marmarth, right? North Dakota, the center of the universe, population about 95.
Right. Wow.
That's where I met you, and I went back and read what Kirk wrote about you and our encounter but Kirk knew you beforehand, but I met you like 24 years ago. You were like 17, still in high school, and I do remember like we came to your garage and you got to meet this guy. Meet this kid, man. He's just so cool and he's got so many fossils. And sure enough, he stepped in. You had taken over your dad's garage. It was full of fossils. And that you had found. But also, I mean, I remember coming away from that as Kirk and I were driving all around the Western United States working on our Fossil Freeway book. And we were wondering what was going to happen to Tyler when he grew up. And we were wondering if you would turn to commercial, could you go to commercial and start making money off of this? Or if you go the academic route and you went the academic route.
Follow the true way, Padawan.
I had, folks offering, coming to my house when I was in middle school and, high school, one with a briefcase full of cash.
No
way.
Wanted
to buy some of these fossils.
Well, like, what kind of fossils did you have as a, 15-year-old? T-Rex teeth?
Yeah, Rex teeth, pachycephalosaur domes.
Really?
I found an articulated thescalosaur. I was in sixth grade, I found an articulated duckbill dinosaur with skin impressions. So,
what?
I
always say I peaked in like seventh or eighth grade.
That's fantastic.
But yeah, you were actually taking diggers out. And so your family owns a lot of the Hell Creek Badlands, right? For cattle and ranching or?
Yep, that's right. Yes, my grandparents who've passed, their family owned a bunch of land. That's been passed down to their kids. It's now being passed down to my cousins. A good place to grow up and a good family to have.
And then recently something was just found there and then you brought a camera crew in, right?
Can you
just walk us through what happened, the story of that beast that's lurking behind you there? And then we'll dive into turtles.
I love turtles now.
But let's talk about that beast. What happened?
Yeah, I mean, so this is the most fun story, I think. And, you know, a couple of years ago, a buddy that I went to high school with, Sam Fisher, he starts sending me pictures of he and his kids and his nephew out looking for fossils. And I'm like, this is awesome because everybody, I think, that grows up in that area should be out looking for fossils because they're everywhere. It's the Hell Creek Formation. It's the most famous rock unit. I mean, it's where you find T-Rex and all of these awesome things. But, you know, there's just not a lot of people locally that I think go out and look for fossils. But his boy, Jessen, was really interested in becoming a paleontologist. And one year he sent me a picture of himself dressed up as me for Halloween, which I thought was adorable. And but, you know, he sent me a picture of them holding a piece of petrified wood or a cool rock. And I'd be like, it's not a dinosaur, but it's a cool fossil, right? I mean, it's still
from the Peel Shale.
Keep looking. You're getting close.
Yeah. And that's what I said. I said, I guarantee it, Sam. Like, if you guys keep looking, you will find a dinosaur. I mean, they're everywhere out there in the, in the Hell Creek. And so, and then in 2022, in July of 2022, he sends me a picture of his youngest boy, Liam, lying down next to the leg of an articulated dinosaur. And it was awesome because, you know, I could see it was a decent dinosaur because I could see the femur. I could see it was articulated with the tibia and fibula. So you don't find too many articulated dinosaurs out in the Hell Creek. I mean, obviously they're there. So I was just super excited. I was like, you know, congratulations. You guys did it. Like, that's awesome. You know, tell the boys I'm super proud of them. And
did you assume it was a duck bill?
And I thought it was a duckbill. So based on the photos, I mean, it was hard to see. The side of a leg isn't the most diagnostic part of an animal. And so I'm like, it looks like a duckbill. And, you know, and again, I was just super excited for him. And basically it wasn't until the next day then. Like, so we go back and forth, the congratulatory aspect. And then the next day I was like, Sam, like, whose land was that dinosaur found on? Because land ownership is a big deal.
Yeah. First question to always ask, yes.
Yeah. I mean, ever since Sue sold, and then more recently Stan. I mean, and then we have the apex
Stegosaurus. Our last episode, Tyler.
With Pete.
So whose land was it on?
And whose land? So he texted me right back. He knew exactly whose land it was on. He's like, it was on the Bureau of Land Management. And I'm like, that is awesome. You did exactly the right thing. I mean, you can go out and look for fossils on BLM. You can't pick them up, right, if you don't have a permit. And he and his kids did the right thing. They found them. They sent a photo to an expert, which fortunately for me was me. Yeah. and that's, you know, so I was like, well, that's fantastic. I said, now I can go get the permit and then you and the boys can join me on this dig next year. And he's like, that would be awesome. It's been a, you know, dream of my boys to go out and, you know, be able to dig up a dinosaur with you. And so I was like, well,
here's the one they found.
Yeah. And then, so then fast forward a little bit. So the last star to a kind of a line in all of this is that a film company, a few months later, they reach out to me and they're like, you know, so this is Giant Screen Films, and they call me out of the blue and they're like, hey, we're doing this film on T-Rex and we need an opening scene in the Hell Creek Formation. We're on a dinosaur dig. You know, to set the stage for T-Rex, like, do you have any digs going on this year? We know you're one of the main players in the Hell Creek. And I said, I don't have a T-Rex, but boy, do I have a dinosaur made for TV. Boys go out.
Kids
go out and find this awesome dinosaur, right? And it just doesn't get any better.
Because then.
Unless it's a T-Rex. So... And so that's how we had that crew aligned. So they're like, oh, that's such a cool story. And so they came out. They were planning on joining us for like a day or two. And so now we'll fast forward a little bit more to July of 2023. And we go out there. And at this point, I kind of had some suspicions that it was a tyrannosaur because I could see the broken up bone in the photos and the way a T-Rex breaks up. It breaks up into sheets. It's kind of like porcelain breaking up. Mm. And so I sent a picture of it to one of my buddies, a fellow curator at a major museum. I won't say who it was.
Okay.
Because I'm like, am I crazy or could this be a T-Rex?
Yeah.
And he's like, nah, man, like, it looks like a duck bill. I'm like, yeah, like, okay. Odds are, right? Second most common dinosaur in the Hell Creek. So anyway, we go out to the dig and I see the dinosaur for the first time, you know, with the kids there. And I even have more suspicions. And so we do all the filming and whatnot. And then finally we're ready to start digging, right? And so like, the cameras were rolling. Jessen and I are digging in one spot. I have a whole army of people out there with me, you know, 18 interns and their mom was out there. Like a bunch of people were out at the dig at the time. And so Jessen and I were digging and together, like, we uncover the lower jaw of this T-Rex with a bunch
of teeth
sticking out.
On camera.
On camera? How far underneath the surface was it?
6 inches.
Yeah.
Wow. What kind of matrix? Was it easy? Was it brushable or?
Yeah, you could dig it with your fingernail. I mean,
it was just like the opening scene in Jurassic Park. Yeah. Yeah. Pretty much. Like,
it was as close to a Jurassic Park scene as I've ever come in my 30 plus years of digging. So.
Wow. What's the name of this film?
So the film is called T-Rex.
It's in IMAX.
It's playing in giant screen films around the country. I think it's in over 100 different venues right now, including our museum, the Denver Museum.
The specimen is at the Denver Museum now, right?
That's right. Yeah. So then we brought the dinosaur back. So we spent the next 11 days digging it. Let me back up. I mean, the moment we uncovered the T-Rex, it was just such an emotional moment because Justin and I lock eyes and we're like, oh my God, it's a T-Rex. My interns, like, their eyes are going every direction. They're like, holy cow, it's my first dinosaur dig. This is wild. And then Danielle, the mom, she's out there. She starts bawling, right? I mean, there was just so many emotions on the outcrop. It was awesome. It was a moment I'll never forget just because it was just such a special moment.
It's magical.
That is so, so very, very cool, man. Why do turtles resonate with you? Does it go back to an early discovery, Tyler?
That is an interesting question. I mean, I think it runs even deeper. I've always been fascinated by turtles. I've always wanted to, way back, my earliest discoveries were always dinosaurs. I found really great dinosaurs, when I was in, 10, 11 years old. And then, but I'd be out there and I'd find little chunks of turtle shell. You know, pieces of turtle shell are just everywhere out in the Hell Creek, but finding a nice complete shell is quite rare. And so I was always drawn to them. So, I don't know. I think for me, it's like being a paleo nerd, like turtles, it runs deep for me.
Curiosity was piqued early on.
It was, yeah. And, you know, I went to did my undergrad on sort of the developmental origin of the turtle shell. And then I went from there to do my PhD on the origin of the turtle shell. So I've always been fascinated by the shell, how it developed. And from where did it come, right? I mean, it's just an interesting thing. And I thought there was a lot of great questions, outstanding questions with turtles that were unanswered.
And to this day, they're unanswered.
To a certain degree, yeah. I mean, there's still a lot of debate. I mean, that's fascinating because they're still alive. We can get a lot of data from, you know, living creatures.
Yeah.
You know, with fossil animals, we're kind of limited by the amounts of data we can get. Right, you can't get the molecular data, but with turtles, there was still is a lot of debate as where the shell came from. So there, you know, to me, it's always been fascinating, and I guess that's what I did my PhD on, just because I could see there was lots of big juicy questions out there to be answered.
Well, give us a brief evolutionary history, starting from just before the Permian, the Karoo fossil finds of Eunotosaurus, and what's just before Eunotosaurus, which is the first skeleton that shows the ribs just starting to not really fuse, but they're getting bigger. Mm-hmm. And it's obviously turtle-like. It's a stem turtle, correct?
Well,
it's an idea that I've put forth, and I think the community is largely supportive of Eunotosaurus being an early turtle.
Well, let's start just before Eunotosaurus and give us a brief evolutionary history for our listeners.
Yeah, so you'd have an animal that looks a lot like a lizard. And, you know, it has 18 presacral, you know, vertebrae.
In the Permian.
Yeah, this would be probably the, you know, the middle Permian.
Okay.
About 270. So that's 280 million years is about when we think turtles would have split off from other reptiles, whoever those reptiles might be, right? Because that's a whole nother question of who turtles are related to. But it would have had probably a pretty normal body plan. But I think one of the earliest things that we see anatomically, the earliest thing that we see developmentally sort of changing, you know, on its way to becoming a turtle is the broadening of these ribs. And so that's probably what we, you know, what we would have seen. The earliest fossil record that we have is Eunotosaurus. So I'm kind of speculating on pre-Eunotosaurus. But you would have probably had an animal like Miloretto that has these, you know, broadened ribs.
Well, I'm just wondering that with the ribs, you're talking about, is that the ribs start growing out and they become part of the shell, the upper shell?
They become the shell.
Yeah.
But there's a top and a bottom to the shell, right?
Well, yep. The bottom is the plastron, which is from the sternum. Is that like a...
No, this is crazy.
Yeah, no, I know. I mean, turtles are wild. I mean, yes, so the
there's nothing like them. That's a weird thing. There's nothing like them in the entire animal kingdom.
Hmm.
Exactly. There's nothing. I mean, yeah. So the top shell, they have a top shell, bottom shell. The top shell is the carapace. It's formed by broadened ribs.
Wow.
Broadened neural spines. And then the very bone in the very front is part of the shoulder girdle.
Oh, the plastron, the belly?
Well, no, I'm just talking about the carapace.
Oh,
and
right.
So then you go on to the belly, the plastron, those anterior bones are shoulder girdle bones as well. So here you have the evolutionarily, the splitting of the shoulder girdle, some bones going into the top shell, bones going into the bottom shell, and then the remaining bit of the plastron or gastralia. And so turtles
what's
are
that?
One of the few
what's,
groups.
What's, I'm sorry, so help us out. What's gastralia?
Yeah, they're modified scales, essentially. Oh. So you look at a T-Rex has gastralia. Like so the
like
belly.
Scoots?
Like belly ribs. Yeah, sort of like scutes and heavily, right. You know, a bunch of scales that form like these long cylinders. They're belly ribs. They're kind of floating.
But basically in skin, right? I mean, if you're just saying surface skin that becomes hardened and...
No, it's all bone.
Yeah, I mean, it's intramembranous bone. So it's the ossification of tissue without a cartilaginous intermediate. So it's...
That's a mouthful.
The later
turtles have a third bone that rings around the turtle, right? And what is that called and where did that come from? Because I watched your evolutionary animation from the Eunotosaurus to some Cretaceous turtle, I think it was.
Yep.
And they've been around 200 million years as turtles?
Fully shelled turtles have been around since the Triassic. And so 210 million years ago, you were to beam back in time and you could go to the Triassic, you would recognize turtles as a turtle. You wouldn't necessarily recognize other animals that were alive or have ancestors alive today, like mammals or these bipedal crocs running around during the Triassic. But
wait, this fossil in the Karoo, okay, this Eunotosaurus, it's called a Eunotosaurus.
Eunotosaurus.
Yeah.
You know this.
You know that?
Yeah, I know this. There you go.
So when you look at the skeleton, it looks just like wide ribs, but it's not a shell. When do you see the first shell in the time frame?
So it kind of gets into the question of like what makes a shell, right? I mean, what are the more turtle-like than
more wide rib-like?
Because you go to 220 million years ago and you have a thing called Odontocheles. And this was a pivotal specimen, right, that changed our views on turtle evolution. It certainly changed my view on turtle evolution. But there, Odontocheles has broad ribs, and then it has a fully developed plastron.
So but it looks like a wide monitor lizard. That's what artist representation looked like, right?
Yeah. And swimming around, so thought to be aquatic, swimming around in the near shore marine environments. But what's cool is that it doesn't have a fully developed top shell. But it has a fully developed belly shell or plastron. So that's a really important clue, you know, as to what forms first. And it's also what we see developmentally.
Yeah.
You know, the development and the phylogenetic appearance of certain of these features sort of mirrors each other. Because the first thing we see developmentally, broadened ribs. That's what we see if you notice Eunotosaurus. The next thing that we see are broadened vertebrae. And then we see the plastron. And that's what we see with Odontocheles.
When you say developmentally, is that as it's in the womb or something? Or in the egg, I mean?
Yeah. You can take, you know, a modern-day snapping turtle and see when certain bones appear.
That's what you're talking about.
In the egg, yeah. And that's what's cool, with turtles. With any organism that's alive, you can get a lot of different types of data, including ontogenetic data, molecular data.
The ontogeny represents the phylogeny.
Recapitulates right. All
yep.
that, yes.
And that doesn't always, it's not always
it's not
the case,
always true, yes.
And so why would you want a belly shell? Predators from below was an idea, and then they're sliding down into the water?
Yeah, I think the idea that I like the best, and this is, was put forth in a paper, was it kind of acts as a ballast.
Oh.
Right, a little bit of a weight. Because I don't like the protection idea just yeah. because, you know, and imagine an animal coming up from the bottom. These things aren't that big, right? An yeah. Odontochelys is only...
You're going to swallow it whole.
Yeah, it would swallow it whole. It would chew down, right? It would bite, you know, the belly might be protected, but then you have the teeth coming through the top yeah. and piercing the yeah. lungs. So I don't really know what type
so
of
ballast,
protective.
So ballast, that makes sense.
Yeah, because they're found in aquatic environments. And acting as a little as a ballast, so that's what I like for the origin, the earliest origin of the plastron.
Why do you think they made it through the Cretaceous extinction?
It's so obvious.
No, they're the only marine reptile, though. The marine
no,
reptile.
Well, hold on a second. They're not.
They're the only marine reptile to make it through, right?
No, crocodilians. Well, anything okay. that could yeah. burrow or hide in the water or have 6 months of hibernation in a hole is going to miss all the bad stuff. And wasn't
think,
it
Tyler?
True that after the KPG event that it was a world of turtles and crocs?
Yeah, undoubtedly. I mean, particularly turtles. I mean, they're the most common thing you find before the mass extinction in the Hell Creek, and they're also the most common thing you find in the very earliest Paleocene sediments. And so I think you're right. I mean, I think it has to do with the fact that they're buffered. If you're underground, underwater, you're buffered from that thermal pulse. From the Chicxulub impactor, you because you have to survive many things, but that was the first thing you have to survive is sort of that thermal pulse. And so being underground, underwater, that was a good way of dealing with that. And then if you're able to have a broad diet, that's another important thing. And then sort of estivate, brumate or hibernate and sort of hunker down for many, many months.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing is that underwater, there were a lot of things. Mosasaurs, plesiosaurs, ammonites, they all go. But somehow the aquatic turtles are the ones that seem to sail through. Do they actually go through the extinction? Do the species go through?
The largest terrestrial species to make it through the KPG extinction is a big soft-shell turtle called Axisthemes.
And it was like 3 or 4 feet long, right? It was big.
Its shell is about, three and a half feet in diameter. So really big, big animal. We have species in the Hell Creek, and then we have species in the earliest Paleocene. And so I think that's an interesting question of like, what are the largest animals that survived this mass extinction?
Well, you did a paper, and I know I'm digressing a little bit here, but I saw in your research a paper on really big gar.
Yep.
Gar that make it through the Cretaceous, the KPG extinction. And I have a thing for gars because wherever you go, there you gar. So many beautiful puns that can be had.
Geez.
I'm sorry. I have to do it, Dave.
Well,
what is your research on the gar? And what did it show about that making it through the extinction?
Yeah, so I mean, this was a really cool fossil. I mean, so I found it's my big fish story.
I want to hear it, man.
I found this alligator gar, a beautiful skull and part of the vertebrae and scales coming out of the hill. And then I was out with my interns and we were digging down to collect it. And we dig right through the KPG boundary in an area that you're familiar with, Ray, near Mud Buttes. And
uh-huh.
So as you know, Mud Buttes has a really nice distinct line, KPG boundary
line. Oh, yes. I was right there. Yes.
You were there for the discovery.
Yes. Of that layer. Yeah.
And so I collected the whole fish with the boundary below it. And so this fish is found within just a few centimeters of the actual boundary. And so then you can start to look at different average sedimentation rates to figure out, like, well, when was this fish swimming in this big pond? You know, how many thousands of years after the KPG mass extinction?
Let me guess, 100,000 years?
Oh, no, with any of the age models, we're talking within a few thousand, one to 5,000 years after the extinction. And so here you have an apex predator living in a freshwater ecosystem within a few thousand years.
Yeah, and was able to eat something to support that size. How big was this specimen?
It was about a meter and a half.
I mean, so there was prey. There were other things made it through for it to eat.
Right, like big turtles.
Yeah.
Big turtles. Gars.
So this past August, I was swimming in the Yellowstone River with my son out of Glendive, Montana.
Mm-hmm. Oh, cool.
Were there gars swimming around us that we couldn't see in the murky river?
Undoubtedly, right? I mean, that river's
alligator gosh, or those more southern.
Those are south. You'd have like the needle.
Let's just put it this way: you wouldn't want to be skinny dipping there, Dave.
Well, there's no candiru in the.
Anyways, gar will hit anything. But actually, so speaking of that Mud Butte site and gars and fish, there's a pretty famous site called Tanis. Tanis, very near there, actually a couple of miles from there, only you can see it from the buttes there. We can dive back into the turtles here in a minute, but while we're talking Tanis, what are your opinions on Tanis and the extraordinary claim that it's the actual day?
Yeah, so I actually unknowingly visited Tanis many years ago, along with Kirk Johnson, with Steve Nicholas, he and his team are the ones who actually found that locality. And we actually have a block of fish from the Tanis locality here at the museum that Steve Nicholas donated before he passed away. And that locality is incredible. Right, there's no doubt about it. It's a Lagerstätten. It's an amazing locality. Just chock full of amazing fish.
Are there
spherules
in it? Are there tektites, spherules?
So my block has no spherules.
Right.
And so I know that some of the blocks in the Field Museum, they've been reported to have no spherules as well. So I don't know. I mean, I would love for...
Yeah, but it depends on where that block came from in the Tanis site, according to De Palma's claims, right?
Yeah, exactly. So I don't know, right? I mean, if you look at, in his 2019 paper, he shows spherules all through the section.
Yeah, but it was only through like a foot or so of sediment. It wasn't like meters and meters.
But it was through the two bone-producing horizons.
Oh, right. Okay.
We know, like, even at Mud Buttes, you can go a few meters laterally and not find any spherules.
Sure.
Right? I mean, the boundary clay, it's such a thin layer that it can move around.
Well, I'm sure that paper's coming out real soon.
Yeah. So, I've been waiting for Robert to publish more on that locality,
okay,
particularly all of the other feathers and everything else. There's been a lot reported.
Yeah. There's a chicken leg. Leg.
The Thescalosaurus. Yeah, exactly. And so
easy for you to say. The gecko and the ember, or whatever.
Yeah. All right. Well, let's move on.
Okay.
Turtles.
All right, back to the turtles.
I was going to say, Tyler, did you hear the discovery yesterday that they found the transitional turtle? And you're going to go, what? And I said,
Seriously.
Nobody did. But why? Why is there, I mean, just not enough fossils, why is there not that missing link? Or is there?
Well, I think there is, right? I mean, but I think if you were to go back 12 years ago, you could have asked that question. That was a legit question then, because you go the earliest turtles that we had prior to the discovery of Odontochelys.
Right.
And I guess that was in 2009.
Okay.
Was Praganochelys and these other fully shelled turtles. And so it was actually one of the animals that was used by creationists to argue for, against evolution. And because there was no transitional forms. And that was the case for over 100 years. We have the oldest turtle already has a shell. So like, how did the shell form? Like, well, we don't know, because all we can look at is the developmental data from extant animals.
Right.
But then 2009 comes along and we have Odontochelys. And that was, a mind-blowing event for a lot of us, because I always thought the shell formed via the acquisition of lots of osteoderms, not by broadening of the ribs.
Right.
So there are these two different ideas for the origin of the shell. Developmental biologists saying like broad ribs, and eventually those ribs suture together to form the shell. And then paleontologists were like, no, it's osteoderms, and then they meld with the underlying
ribs. And osteoderms
ribs.
Are bony plates, pretty much.
Bony plates.
That suture together.
Yeah, exactly. And so then we have Odontochelys that comes along, broad ribs, no osteoderms, clearly a turtle. So it changed our search image for what the even earlier proto-turtle should look like.
And where does that fall with the Eunotosaurus? Before? It's after the Eunotosaurus, right?
After, yeah.
How and many so million that's, years?
It's 40. Because Odontochelys is 220.
Right.
And so to me, that was a life-changing discovery that I didn't make, right? It was a life-changing read, I should say, when I read that paper in Nature, because it changed my image for like what the earlier ones should look like. And so then I started thinking about Eunotosaurus, which had been found and described 100 years earlier, essentially, and had been argued it is a turtle. No, it's not a turtle. And then eventually people were like, well, we know the turtle shell forms via the acquisition of osteoderms, not by the broadening of the ribs. Eunotosaurus has broad ribs, but no osteoderms. Therefore, it can't be a turtle. So it was completely circular reasoning, right? And so that's why O'Donoghue's sort of pulled us out of that circular reasoning quagmire that a lot of us were in.
You've got some marvelous videos that you've worked with animators on that help explain this, right? That we can share on our website. And
absolutely.
Along with a bunch of charts.
Yeah, it's like a 3-minute video that shows, does it start with Eunotosaurus and it ends up in a fully formed turtle?
Exactly. Yeah, I always joke, you know, it's 260 million years of evolution in a 1.5-minute long video.
Yeah, perfect. That's what I like. Where is O'Donoghue's from?
So O'Donoghue's is from China.
China.
One of these amazing fossil-bearing, you know, units in China. Spectacular animal.
It's Triassic?
Yeah.
Is it Triassic? Okay, all right.
Yeah, and so it's a little bit older than the shelled turtles, like Pergannocheles and these things from, you know, again, for over 100 years, that's all we had to go by. Then O'Donoghue's comes along in China, blows our minds, right? And so then I start working on Eunotosaurus. And then what's great, so I work up Eunotosaurus and start talking about all the ways in which it's a turtle, at least, you know, looking at the histology and the way it develops and all of its anatomy. But then in the meantime, two additional specimens are found, two additional species, one in Germany at 240 million years old, and then another one in China at 225. So now we have 260, 240, 225, 220, 210, and then we're off to the races. And so to answer your initial question there is like, we do have a lot of these transitional fossils now.
Wow.
It's been a golden age for turtle evolution.
Turtle heads.
So with the development of the shell, it starts with the broadening of the ribs and then the plastron and then what's next? It goes back to the shell fusing into a disc, the concave disc?
Yeah, so you have the ribs, and then you have the vertebrae, and then you have the belly, the plastron. And then the last thing you get is that acquisition of all the bones along the perimeter. And that's what you see developmentally.
What are those called? They're little diamonds that they're around the perimeter, and then they fuse into the plastron and the carapace, right?
Yep, and so those are just, they're called peripherals.
Peripherals.
Along the periphery.
Pretty obvious, okay.
Yeah. Us paleontologists are pretty basic human beings, you know.
Yeah. Well, no, you're more prone to very long words, but when you use something like peripheral, it's very cool. So thanks for that.
There's also a couple of discoveries, and that is you found the Escalante staircase Cretaceous turtle with eggs.
Yeah, we've got, I mean, that area, Grand Staircase Escalante National Monument, that is just a spectacular assemblage of fossils. And so we have one group, which I haven't published on yet. It's one of my many things I need to get busy and publish on, but we found six different basalemmies. These big...
What?
So basalemmies, it's like a big, maybe it has a shell about 3 foot long. Its shell is very flat. It was like a tortoise, not related to a tortoise, but it was living on land. It was eating plants. It was doing a lot of tortoise-like things, just phylogenetically not related. But anyway, we found a bone bed of basalemmies, and two of them have eggs inside their shells.
Wow.
Which is pretty
wild.
Are
there embryos in the eggs or no?
No embryos, right. Because, it, you know, as a turtle would have laid its eggs, and then then the embryo, you know, would have started to ossify much later, not when they're inside of the belly.
A turtle, when it lays its eggs, it's like a regular chicken egg, and you put it on the pan. It's fertilized, but it's...
That's right.
Yeah.
Yep. Exactly.
Watch out, baby turtles.
Do they have parthenogenesis, or do they need, is it sexual...
Yeah, it's sexual. They're not, you know, they're not that bizarre.
Right.
Oh, yeah.
Bizarre in many other ways.
Well, a couple of just kind of dumb questions, maybe dumb. They say there are no dumb questions, but maybe. What is the difference between a turtle and a tortoise?
Good question.
Yeah, it is a great question. So I would say all tortoises are turtles, but not all turtles are tortoises. And so
explain, please.
Yeah, I mean.
And also tell us when they split off.
Yeah, so basically a tortoise, it's a group of turtle,
okay.
Mostly land animals, and they split off about in the Eocene.
Oh, really?
Yeah, they're pretty recent ones, but there were animals, other groups of turtles. That's why I was saying with Basilemmes, that's tortoise-like. So evolutionarily, they're not related to tortoises, but they were doing all of the tortoise-like things ecologically.
So turtles have been marine most of their history, really?
Well, so the earliest turtles were, you know, these earliest proto-turtles were living on land.
Right.
And then the earliest turtles that sort of make up the modern diversification of turtles seems to have been aquatic.
Why would a lizard want to turn into a turtle? Why have that ability? Is it because it's aquatic?
Well, I think if you go to the end game, it's for protection. It's kind of like with the bird feather. Why would you want to have the feathers? And it wasn't for flight,
right?
Because obviously modern day birds are using their feathers for flight. But evolutionarily, that wasn't why the feather evolved. Right?
It was sexual color, selection. Yeah, we think color and
thermoregulation. Yeah, sexual selection.
Yeah.
And so I think it's the same thing, because I think that's a great question. Why broaden your ribs? Right? There's many reasons as to why you wouldn't want to broaden your ribs. And the first reason is respiration. Like, take a deep breath.
Right.
That's right. Turtles don't breathe the way any other animal breathes. They have explain that one.
You have to get away around from that. So if you go back evolutionarily, like, the earliest amniotes were costal ventilators. They were using their ribs to help ventilate their lungs.
With a diaphragm.
No. So that's a mammalian thing. So if you go early on, and they're largely just using their ribs to ventilate their lungs. There's a problem with that because they're also using it for locomotion, right? So all of the muscles here in your hypaxial musculature, when you're there at the gym doing core, like you're working your hypaxial muscles.
Okay.
And so evolutionarily, you can only do one or the other. You can't do them both simultaneously, I guess. Not evolutionarily, but you can't do them simultaneously. And so what that means is you can't run and breathe at the same time.
Extant lizards nowadays have to hold their breath when they run.
That's right. And so that's why their strategy is to go up a tree or down a hole to get away, because they're holding their breath. And so this is something that was called carrier's constraint after David.
The carrier's constraint. I like that. Okay.
Has a ring to it.
So wait, if you don't have a diaphragm, you don't make your ribs expand. How do you breathe if you don't have a diaphragm? Something's got to move to pull the air in your lungs.
Well, that's why even like moving like this, right? I mean, that type of walking, that sprawling walking, like you're changing the volume of your cavity.
You're breathing
there.
Through walking?
Locomotion? And just moving your ribs, right? All of that muscles you can use. You have those muscles like in lizards. You see them sitting there, and they're moving their rib cage back and forth because they don't have a diaphragm.
Right.
Well, the point is that early on, a lot of these animals use their ribs for two things. There was a dual function: breathing and for locomoting. You can only use those muscles for one thing at a time. All the amniote groups found ways around that, because obviously it's beneficial to breathe and to locomote at the same time. Mammals found the solution through the diaphragm. Turtles found the solution through a muscular sling. So they have a muscle that attaches to the front of their shell, loops around the guts and everything, you know, and then it reattaches in the back of the shell. So it creates a muscular bag. And when that muscular bag contracts, it goes up, it pushes the guts next to the lungs, and the animal expires. And then when it goes down, the animal breathes in.
So it is. It is a diaphragm.
Yeah. The diaphragm is very specific to mammals. But crocs have the piston. Birds have they have a very different way of breathing, you know, unidirectional flow. I mean, it's very, very specialized, and it's all to circumvent and be able to, you know, that carrier's constraint, circumvent carrier's constraint and locomote and breathe at the same time.
There's going to be a link to carrier's constraint. I like more detail in your page here, Tyler.
Yeah. That's the name of my new band, The Carrier's Constraint.
Right.
But I have two questions, though. Tortoise and turtle, can you tell the difference at a glance physically? Is there a difference?
Yeah, for the most part, yeah. I mean, of course, all turtles kind of look the same, including right. tortoises. But I mean, tortoises are generally much higher domed.
Okay, just
a much higher dome shell.
Think of Galapagos tortoise and a leatherback. They're very, very
very
different.
Distinct looking.
Yeah.
Can a box turtle completely close itself in, like, into an airtight?
Well, not airtight, but right. I mean, it's so tight that, you know, like a raccoon or other animals right. really can't peel itself out. I mean, yeah. I mean, and that's what a defense mechanism, right? Turtles are never the fastest or whatever, but they have an incredible defense mechanism to be able to pull all of their limbs in, their heads in, inside of their protective shell, inside of their rib cage.
Yeah.
Right? Their cervical vertebrae are going inside of their ribs.
Right.
That's bizarre.
It is bizarre.
That's a neat party trick.
And what's the coolest thing about a turtle?
One of the fun facts is how long a turtle can go without oxygen. And these have been some interesting studies that other folks have done, but not me. But Alan Jackson did some really great studies, you know, putting turtles inside of chambers, pulling out all the oxygen, and then seeing how long they could last. Like, right, you and I are going to last 45 seconds. Right, without oxygen, we're not going to last very long. And some of these turtles could last up to 6 months.
What?
Yeah, 6 months, I mean, without a breath?
Without a breath. They're able to go and, you know, to estivate, they slow their metabolism
way down.
You know, their heartbeat is beating so slowly.
I did not know this.
One beat an hour, right?
Yeah. It's crazy. And then one of the things that kills you is the buildup of lactic acid. Turtles are able to buffer that buildup of lactic acid by pulling different calcium and other types of ions out of their shell.
But what's the difference between brumate and, you said, ectivate?
Yeah, they're the same. Yeah, I mean, they're essentially the same thing. I mean, it's the reptilian form right. of hibernating.
Well, you know, right. this makes me feel a lot better, because last summer when I was in Kansas, I was snorkeling and we were sampling a lot of fish and stuff. It was this thing called fish wizards. And we had a net out overnight, and there was a snapping turtle that got stuck in it. And the next day we pulled it out and like, oh, my God, we've drowned the snapping turtle. But then as it laid there, it's very slowly. Everybody said, just leave it alone, you know, mm-hmm. and after it came back. So yeah, I thought we had killed it. So
yeah,
I once read years ago that given the right environmental conditions, it's possibly a turtle could live indefinitely without predation, with the proper amount of food.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not an expert in aging and whatnot, but they are one of the longest lived vertebrates, right? Yeah. I mean, there's like the Greenland shark, and there's other animals that can live
there's
for
Darwin's,
a long,
Darwin's
long...
Galapagos turtle died in 2006 at 175 years. Imagine that. He yep. found it.
Yeah. No, exactly. They're probably living up to over 200 years.
Really?
I don't know about indefinitely. I think yeah. gravity wow. and Mother Nature are, you know...
Right.
But something will take you down.
Yeah.
What is the biggest turtle of all time?
Archelon.
Stupendames.
What is
it? Oh, who?
Yeah, Stupendames. So this is this turtle that lived in South America during the Eocene. And it was even bigger than Archelon. And
it's a land turtle.
The size of a Volkswagen Beetle. No, I would have lived in it was aquatic. I mean, that's the thing, right?
You'd have to be for that size.
Exactly. Yeah, you kind of cheat gravity, right, by going into the water. And so
I do that all the time.
Really big. Yeah.
How big?
I mean, I've never seen one, but I've always wanted to go down there and see an actual shell. But I mean, their shells are Archelon is ginormous. It's like, you know, 12 feet in diameter.
Wow.
It's a big disc.
Enough about the turtles. I'm just endlessly fascinated with it. Yeah, I love them. I want to be a turtle. I could live so long.
What's more important than turtles, right?
Well, maybe, Tyler came across a really cool thing. I think it's in the Paleocene, some fossils that had been ignored. What about those, Tyler? There was even a Nova TV show I got to watch.
Yeah, so, you know, I've always been fascinated by the Cretaceous-Paleogene boundary,
yeah.
right? What caused the extinction? And, you know, over the last 40 years, we have a good idea what caused that mass extinction. Like,
wasn't it the Shiva impact crater off of India? Yeah. Just kidding.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Spoiler alert, giant impact in a different spot of the part of the world.
Yeah.
But, you know, I grew up in looking and finding all these dinosaur fossils. And then I'd always cross this line, right?
The line.
Cretaceous Paleogene boundary. And below that line, fossil after fossil after fossil. Above that line, devoid of fossils. And so I was, of course, I always wanted to find fossils from that interval of time because I knew there'd be a cool story to tell. And so I got a job at the Denver Museum and I'm thinking, like, I need to go make a big discovery. And I think that discovery needs to, you know, like, there's a lot to be told about what happens after the KPG mass extinction. And so I team up with my buddy Ian Miller, who's a paleobotanist, and we're like, we're going to go somewhere in the world and we're going to find a fossil deposit from right after the KPG mass extinction. And so we're looking at like Bolivia and Peru and Argentina and all
exotic
these places.
Yeah.
Because that discovery can't be made in your backyard, right? I mean, like, it's got to be some far-flung place. And so, but we're like, well, we should probably go down and look at this area called Corral Bluffs, which is part of the Denver Basin, which has been worked for over 100 years by the Smithsonian, by my own museum, the Denver Museum of Nature and Science.
By Kirk Johnson.
I've been there with him. I've been there. I whacked a few rocks. Yeah,
exactly. Right. I mean, it's right here. It's a lovely spot. And so we go down there, you know, because it's local. It's an hour and a half drive here from my museum. And a volunteer of ours had found one reasonably complete partial mammal skull. And I'm always of the opinion, if there's one, there's got to be two, right? There's got to be more. There's got to be more complete fossils to be found. And so I went down there and I've always had this idea, you know, of concretions, right? People find fossils and concretions all the time. That's how you find amazing ammonites and amazing marine fossils.
Lobsters and crabs.
Basically, it's a ball of mud, rock. It's a sphere.
That forms around an organic organism.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And so I've been in many other areas, you know, in the Williston Basin and other places, cracking open rocks, not finding anything. But at Corral Bluffs, I have the same idea, and I go to Corral Bluffs and I pick up one of these ugly white concretions, these phosphatic concretions, and I crack it open, and a mammal skull from the first million years after the extinction of the dinosaurs is staring back at me. And it was awesome because it was like going to the optometrist and like, you know, like flipping through and all of a sudden, like we flip and we, cause like there's concretions everywhere. Nobody had broken them open.
Wow.
And so it was just a magical moment because I had the volunteer who had found that sort of the first one, Sharon Melito, she was out there with me and Ian was there and we just run around within minutes and we find dozens of complete mammals, turtles, crocodilians, you know, and from this critical interval of time.
How big are these concretions to find a crocodilian?
Yeah, we have 6 foot long concretions with whole crocs preserved inside of them.
6 foot long. Wow.
You know,
with articulated skeletons inside?
All of the osteoderms in place.
No.
I mean, it is insane. And it's unlike any other place where I've been, because usually, like, you know, we go and we look for bone, right? But in this case, we're looking for rocks that are shaped like animals.
Right.
And it's so different than anywhere else I've looked for fossils. And so you really look for shapely rocks, shapely concretions.
So you found how life rebounded after the killing of 75% of all life on planet Earth.
Exactly.
And it rebounds. And how... When you say this is just above the KT boundary, are you talking, you're saying 100,000 years, 50,000 years?
What's cool about this rock unit is we have dinosaurs, and then we have the KPG boundary, and then we have the first million years afterwards. And so, and we have such a rich vertebrate record. So again, tons of mammals, turtles, crocs, and then we have lots of plants.
In my notes, I'm showing by 300,000 years, the ecosystem and animal population diversified, right?
Yep.
So pretty much you had a full-blown ecosystem happening only 300,000 years after the asteroid hit.
Yeah, it's super fast. We see big jumps at 300,000 and then at 700,000. And
really?
So we see new plants appearing on the landscape. Like we have the oldest legume.
I was going to say,
oldest, like,
thanks to
pod.
The bean pod,
yeah.
Thanks to beans,
yeah,
everybody has protein.
Yep. So we dubbed that the protein bar world, where you have new plants on the landscape and then you see a giant jump in body size at the same time. So it's, you know,
everybody's in the chow line at that point. Whoa, yeah.
I have a fact here. By 700,000 years, body size increased 100-fold.
Yeah, and we don't see a comparable jump in body size like that, 100-fold increase for another 35, 40 million years.
Wow. So
it happens fast, right? I mean, 300,000, 700,000. I mean, that's geologically, that is very quick for an ecosystem to sort of bounce back.
How close is the mammal skull after the KPG boundary? Has anyone found anywhere in the world? I mean, 50,000 years, 10,000 years?
We have teeth. Things like that within you know, meters, essentially, or within a meter of the KPG boundary. And so there you're looking at little mouse-sized things.
Right.
The largest mammal to survive the mass extinction is half a kilogram.
Right.
So it's about the size of a rat. And then by you go from a half a kilogram to 300,000 years, you have much larger animals that are 35 times bigger.
Wow.
But the interesting thing, too, everybody always wants to know, do you have primates that early on, our lineage is in there somewhere?
We're going to find them, right? So they've been found, like these early things called plesiadapiforms, which are thought to be stem primates. Those have been found within meters of the KPG boundary up in the Dakotas and Montana.
So we might actually find them back in the Cretaceous at some point, you know, perhaps.
Possibly, yeah. I mean, we have the earliest stem, you know, the earliest putative stem primate, which, again, these plesiadapiforms, and there is debate as to whether or not they're should be there phylogenetically. But anyway.
Do primates evolve all over the world, or do they evolve in North America and then, you know, cross the bridges into Europe and Africa, where we came from?
The earliest ones that we have, again, these plesiadapiforms, they're a North American group.
Really? Like
and
horses?
Then they, then they go over into Asia.
Maybe they rode the horses.
Yeah, there's very, very early primates in North America, yeah.
So there's no other primates anywhere else in the world? Early primates?
No, you find them other places. But, I mean, the earliest ones, these plesiadapiforms.
I'm saying that the earliest ones is what I mean.
Yeah. Yeah, wow. They're from North America.
So we started in North America, and
it's a possibility.
Wow,
it's possible. Yeah, you know, I mean, it's the fossil record will tell all eventually.
We have questions to ask, Ray.
I think we do.
Yeah,
you know,
you have a really good one, and they've been getting better each episode. I've been adding sound effects, and people are loving to answer them too.
Well, what's your favorite color? No, we have changed that one.
No.
It's this one.
I know what it is. It's turtle green.
Yeah.
Tyler, if you could go back in time, what exciting epoch, what perfect period, what exquisite era would you go back to, and what, sir, would you want to see?
Oh man, that is difficult, right? That is.
Come on, man, you can do it.
I know, one shot. I mean, because of course I'm like, oh, I want to go back and see the dinosaurs. That would be super cool. But honestly, I think I would go back to the Permian. I would go back to the Middle Permian. There's evolution of turtles. It's when all the major groups of animals of amniotes are starting to diversify and break off from one another. The turtles, the lizards, the archosaurs.
The premammalian synapsids.
And the premammalian synapsids. Yeah, exactly. It's just evolutionarily, that's what I would want to go back and be able to witness. Even though they're not the biggest and the scariest.
Is there one animal? Pick one animal there you want to see.
It'd have to be Unotosaurus.
All right, there you go.
As boring as that might be. But
true to your turtles,
you
baby.
How big of a paleo nerd I really am.
Yeah,
but when you say amniotes, define amniote.
So things with an amniotic egg.
Okay.
Right? That was one of the major innovations evolutionarily, is when you could lay an egg outside of the water with a membrane and whatnot. And so that's mammals, turtles, crocs, lizards, birds.
Right.
So that's that group. And that's what I've spent my career studying largely are amniotes.
Okay, got it. Well, my question is, how come the study of turtles, which are, as we've discussed, known for their incredible longevity, lower susceptibility to cancers, and of course their ability to brumate, which is their own style of hibernation, How can they provide insights into addressing human aging and age-related diseases? And do you know of any ongoing medical research on this topic?
That is an awesome question that I don't think I have an answer to. I don't know of anybody studying really their overall physiology. There was a group, you know, at the University of Utah. There's Jackson. He wrote a great book, Life in a Half Shell. And he did some really great work on the overall physiology, but not really the anti-aging. So I don't know if I have a good answer right for you, unfortunately. I think that would make for a fantastic career, right? Sure. It would be great, make for a great PhD. And then that's a PhD with legs. You could take that and turn that into a really cool scientific career.
It's probably fundable, too, because
Paleo Nerds has spawned many questions as many answers as well. So,
Well, you know what's cool? I mean, I've learned a lot about turtles with you. And, you know, the fact that they can live so long, but that, you know, keeping their breath for how long? Like, did you say 6 hours?
They can live without oxygen. So
six months. All right, 6 months. Okay, there's some research there because I'd like to do that.
Well, you should, because you live in Alaska where 6 months of the year, it's pretty dark.
I'll just see you next year. One breath, here I go.
Well, Tyler, this is great. We're going to have to come see you over there.
Come visit. You got to come check out this. I mean, all of us, we have an amazing turtle fossil record here at the museum, right? All the turtles that we've collected. And then you have to come check out just this sublime fossil, this T-Rex that was found by these kids. That is one of the most beautiful fossils I've ever seen.
It is stunning. There's no name given to it now yet, is there?
Well, no. So the kids named it. I mean, the museum dubbed it the Teen Rex.
Teen Rex. I like that.
Yeah, that's clever, right? And then the kids named the locality the Brother, which I thought was pretty great
because
they're brothers, they're cousin. They consider him a brother, and then they consider the T-Rex another brother. So
another brother. I like Brother Rex.
They named it the Brother.
That's so cool.
Oh, man.
Very cool.
All right. Well, thanks, man. Tyler, it's been just an absolute blast talking to you, dude.
Yeah, well, thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
I learned a lot. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
Well, that was so much fun. Boy, you get the best guests. I'll tell you, they're just so informative. And now turtles. I know everything about turtles.
Yeah, man, turtles are so cool. You know, I really haven't paid much attention to them, but now I have a deeper understanding. You know,
why? Because they dive deep and they can spend all that time hibernating, brumation.
It's all about the shell, man, the shell.
Yeah.
You know, and they can hold their breath for so long.
Yeah.
It's crazy. They don't get old like me, you know, 200 years. Wow.
We'll have that animation of the evolution of the turtle shell.
Yeah. Yeah. That helps
really
a lot.
Cool. Yeah.
I'm a visual guy. I got to see it there, you know? Tyler, wonderful guy. You know, it's so cool to see, you know, I saw him, knew him, you know, 24 years ago when he was high school and he's gone so far.
When you met him back then, when he was 17, you know, on your stop while you were researching cruising the fossil freeway, did you see a spark in him? Did you see an enthusiasm?
Oh, yeah.
What was
oh, yeah.
it? Was it intelligent? He knew his bones? I mean, what was it?
He knew it all. He was an amazing, I think he was a senior in high school. Kirk said this young man is amazing. And he had been doing the research and the collecting. He already had just a garage full of, you know, just fossils, but he was doing the right thing. And he learned early on, you know, you know, he's not just going to sell them off the land, and this is his family's land. So, you know, it's a deep connection, but I mean, he lived a childhood just rich in fossils. And it was interesting to hear him say that every kid in Marmot, North Dakota should be out looking for bones, and then they do the right thing.
Yeah.
Landowners
it's kind of hard when you have the internet. All right.
So, over and out from rainy old Ketchikan, where the wind is blowing, gusting to 60.
Really? 60?
Yeah.
You're not kidding.
Well, it's got to be. No, it's actually gusting right now, probably 30.
So you have a good winter storm happening right now.
Yeah.
Well, I'm signing off from Ojai, California, where it's a beautiful, going to be 96 today in October.
Enjoy
it. Figure.
Put your sunscreen on.
All right. I'll talk to you from the other side of the planet.
All right, cool. Safe travels, Dave.
Yeah. So, see you, Ray.
Bye.
See ya.
Thanks for being a paleo nerd. Help us spread the word of science. Rate us on Apple Podcasts and follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. You can even email your questions and comments to nerds@paleonerds.com. Did you know each episode is paired with pictures and links? Check out paleonerds.com for photographic evidence that everyone here has been a paleo nerd for a...
KSDP is generously supported by Precision Airways in Sandpoint, Alaska, offering chartered air services throughout the Aleutians Eastboro and beyond. For more information on charters and prices, Theo is available at 907-989-4080. Precision Airways is a proud sponsor of KSDP.
KSDP, 8:30 a.m. in Sandpoint, K201DA, 88.1 FM in King Cove, KOLD, 91.9 FM in Cold Bay, KFPS, 88.1 FM in Falls Pass, and KKQA, 88.1 FM in Accutan, Alaska.
It's time now for your weather, tide predictions, and sunrise and sunset, starting with your coastal water forecast, courtesy of the